Hi, I'm Dan Cottrell, editor of Rugby Coach Weekly. You're about to jump into one of our podcasts. If you want to find out more about this podcast and also all of the great content, drills, activities, games and advice on the website, then go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Be the best rugby coach you can be. Welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with head coach Dan Cottrell, where you learn hints and tips from the rugby coaching community. Let's get started.
Okay, hello and welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with me, Dan Cottrell. I am delighted to welcome to the podcast Anthony Seabold. Welcome to the pod, Anthony.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate the invitation to have a chat to you, mate.
Well, I've been very pleased to catch hold of you. We thought we might have been able to connect before the England internationals, but for those who don't know much about Anthony and his background, he has spent the last, I can't remember how many weeks in England, coaching with Eddie Jones and the rest of the coaches as a defence coach and helping him have a very successful autumn international campaign. So we'll probably touch on that in a moment. He's now back in Sydney with his family. He's actually from a rugby league background, playing for the top teams there and in the UK before taking coaching roles back in Australia with teams like the South Sydney Rabbitohs and Brisbane Broncos. I mean, that's not the only roles he's done. He's done plenty of roles in there, but that's just a very short introduction. So, Anthony, I'm going to jump straight in. I mean, fantastic autumn campaign. How are you feeling about the experience now you're back in Australia?
Yeah, it was a really good experience, you know, really good challenge, you know, coming across from rugby league to rugby union. I'd done some special projects with Eddie over the previous 12 months. So, I watched a lot of rugby and got a lot of, had a lot of shared learning with rugby coaches, over a number of years. So, I'm not unfamiliar with the game, but certainly coming across and working with the elite players in the England team. It was a really good challenge. It was one I was, really up for when Eddie offered the opportunity. So it was good to see our progression through the autumn series. I thought, with each week we probably got a little bit better across a couple of different areas. It was a really good camp. It was really enjoyable. We were all together for just over 4 weeks. And, it was quite positive. And I think the performances showed that as well.
Okay, so immediately you've piqued my interest by saying some special projects with Eddie. Are they super secret or are you allowed to share?
There's probably no secret that my sort of last couple of months of Brisbane Broncos in 2020 was a real challenge, for a number of reasons, performance, COVID, some stuff I was copying on social media, et cetera. And I stepped away from the game. Eddie had been a really good, coaching mentor to me over a number of years. We met each other. He is a South Sydney Rabbitohs supporter. So when I was head coach there, we met on a number of occasions and always stayed in touch in almost some way, shape or form, almost weekly over a couple of year period. And he was the sort of one of the first guys sort of contacted me after I resigned there at Brisbane and said, look, mate, I really value your coaching. Would you once you've had a bit of a break, would you be keen to have a look at, our team, our game, and watch it with a rugby league coach's eye? So, watch it from outside the square, so to speak, so not going into camp, actually, watching the vision of their performances, of opposition teams, et cetera. And I suppose, looking at it as if I was coaching against them from a rugby league perspective, which is a little bit outside the box, so to speak. So that's sort of what I did, the last sort of period of time. I was mainly looking at opposition teams and looking at some opportunities for Eddie to look or explore. But again, it was good for my education because, I'm watching unfamiliar teams, unfamiliar players. But it was a really good lead into, joining England full-time. So, no super secret stuff, just I suppose, you know, coaches from different sports, you know, sharing, you know, their ideas and thoughts. And rugby league and rugby union are very similar in some regard and extremely dissimilar in some regard, if that makes sense. So, you know, there's some really cool principles that, you know, transferable across both games. But, you know, there's some, you know, there's some real subtle differences, and there's some really big differences too.
So what's the rugby league's coach's eye? How's that different from a rugby union coach's eye?
Well, I can't talk, you know, for the rugby union coaches at that particular time, but, you know, I was looking at, you know, how teams were defending. And, you know, look, you know, I see some teams that are really aggressive, you know, and, you know, for want of a better term, you know, use a blitz-style defence. And then you see some teams that want to keep line integrity and are a little bit more passive and are happy to give up some metres on the outside. So, you know, just looking at how teams defend, and in rugby league, you get similar types of defensive systems. So I'll give you an example. The Melbourne Storm in rugby league, they're very aggressive. You know, they'll come and you know, land on you or jam on, you know, the runners out the back of shape. Whereas if you're coaching against, you know, a team that is a little bit less passive, you know, you would attack against them differently. So it's just looking at different ways to attack to start with. And I really enjoyed that. You know, taught me a lot about, you know, why teams are defending, because, you know, France with Sean Evans defend very differently to what the All Blacks do. You know, All Blacks are all about line integrity from what I can see, and France are a lot more aggressive. So, you know, it was really interesting 12-month period, you know, looking at different defensive systems and how I would attack against them. You know, again, you know, just share my ideas with Eddie and one of the football analysts in Kaz Morgan, the RFU. And, you know, what they did with the ideas, you know, who knows, but it was just about provoking some thought and some thinking.
So how do you beat a blitz or a team which is jamming in them?
Oh, you know, there's a number of ways, but I just think, you know, teams that want to jam, there's a couple of things. You know, when Wasps did it back in the mid-2000s, I used to go and spend a bit of time with Sean Edwards. He was the defence coach at Wasps, and Sean and myself played together at London Broncos back in 1999 and 2000. So I'd always stayed in contact with Sean. He was very generous when he was at Wasps and at Wales. I was just starting my coaching journey with a team that had just come to fruition over in South Wales and Celtic Crusaders. This is going back, you know, 16 years ago. And he would allow me to come in and watch training sessions both with Wales and Wasps. And you know, he took a lot of that rugby league aggressive defensive mentality to the game. So, you know, when they started to blitz, you know, teams started to kick in behind, didn't they? You know what I mean? They started to put those kicks in behind the blitz defence. You know, rather than hard punch lines, you know, teams would start to you know, play some tunnel balls, etc. So, yeah, there's certain ways you would play blitz defence. You know, blitz defence is all about trying to take away time and space from the ball players, whereas, you know, teams that sort of will keep their line integrity and work together from the inside, push it towards the sideline, well, they're happy to give up grass. And you know, so you attack them a different way.
Just for the sake of, I know we can't explain every single piece of the jargon, but I will put in the notes what a tunnel ball is. I know what it is, but it does need to be sort of put out on a piece of paper, because it is. I can see how it works on that. So just going back to another point that you've made, you've seen you saw some different improvements improvement in different areas over the time when you were with England. Is it possible to share some of those with us?
Oh, to be fair, you know, things, you know, things like that, I think it's important to be kept in-house. You know, I mean, I'm an assistant coach with England and working really hard to try and, you know, be a resource to the players, be a resource to Eddie and work really hard in that space. So, you know, I prefer not to share publicly what we're seeing in the inner sanctum. But what I can say is, you know, I think it would have been there for all to see, you know, with regards to the improvements on both sides of the ball. You know, I thought across the three games, you know, we scored some fantastic tries and made some fantastic line breaks off the back of, you know, the execution of skill. And, I thought defensively, we worked really hard. What I will say about the fans, and this is what's transferable from rugby league to rugby union and all invasion sports, you know, so invasion sport is, you know, sports like netball and basketball and so on, but it's what you do off the ball that's really important. It's you know, obviously what you do on the ball is important, but what you do off the ball is important. So they're the areas that take an effort or a choice to do. So you know, in rugby union, think about, you know, kick sprint. You know, like it takes an effort. It doesn't take the skill or talent to get in the kick sprint line when you kick the ball down the field on a box kick or a long kick, but it takes a choice to get in the line. You know, kick pressure on a nine off the back of a ruck or putting kick pressure on a number 10 doesn't take talent or take skill. It takes an effort or a choice to go and change the intensity and take some time and space away from him. Things like working really hard from the inside when the ball goes away from you, you know, that doesn't take skill or talent. It takes a choice. And they're transferable from rugby league to rugby union. They're what I call the non-talent required areas of their game. And that's what the starting point is for me in any defensive system in any team sport.
So you're working with these top professionals who are obviously back at their clubs with some very good defence coaches working hard with them. And there will be different systems, that sort of thing. So they're arriving there. How are you going to, and not you, but how does one come into a camp and tell them something they don't know or something which makes them say, right, okay, let's go this way then?
That's really important. Yeah. You know, my other experience in this space is working with the Queensland State of Origin side. Now, for listeners who don't know much about rugby league, you know, it's the biggest sporting event in Australia. It's a three-game series. And it's played between Queensland and New South Wales. And I was the assistant coach of the Queensland side for a couple of years. And you get the very best from all the clubs come into your team, the very best. And one of the things that I thought Queensland did really well, and I saw the same, you know, principle with England was when you come into that team environment, you left your club bag or your club jersey at the door, so to speak. You know, you come in, you bought into what the coaches, you know, wanted to do. You didn't have your club biases, so to speak. It was about putting the team first. And I saw that with the England team. I saw that with Queensland State of Origin side when I was assistant coach with them, doing the same role. I was the defensive coach with Queensland State of Origin. And we had elite players, captains from different clubs, very similar to what you would see with the England rugby team. And there's leaders from the different clubs. There's captains in the different clubs. There's, you know, different ways of doing things in different clubs, but the main thing is to make sure that everyone's rowing in the same direction when you come into a representative environment. That's the key. And Eddie does that extremely well, extremely well. And the leaders do that extremely well. I saw, you know, the players put the team first. And I'm sure in some environments it doesn't always work out like that, but yeah, that's the key, that when you come into a representative environment, you don't have long. In a pre-season, you know, and I'm sure the junior coaches would understand this, even at, you know, underage level, you get an opportunity over pre-season to deconstruct things, you know, to reconstruct over pre-season. So, you know, if the previous year your tackle technique wasn't great or your running lines and attack wasn't great, you get an opportunity to deconstruct that over a pre-season and put it back together over a period of time, you know. And you don't get that at representative level. You have a two-week lead into a first test match. So it's about being simple with your processes and principles. It's about being clear with what you want and not having, you know, 8, 9, or 10 things that you focus on. It really is trying to narrow your focus to the big rocks of 2 or 3 things at most. And that's what I found, you know, really works at representative level. And that's what I tried to do in my particular role with England. And that's what, you know, I tried to do with my particular role when I was the assistant coach for the Queensland State of Origin. So very similar environments. Very, very similar environments. You've got elite players, but you've got to really narrow the focus to a couple of really key things.
So interestingly, with very little time on your hands, a lot of coaching these days, we're talking about player-led, athlete-led, player-centered approaches. To what extent can you use that in that sort of environment, or how much have you got to say, actually, look, guys, there's going to be 8 different views coming in. We know that because you're coming from 8 different starting points. This is the way. How do you get that balance?
No, look, it's about what you do as a coach. So, you know, one thing I did was I contacted a couple of the senior players before coming into camp. You know, England had a mini camp probably 6 weeks before going into camp. So even before that mini camp, I contacted three or four of the key players who I thought would play an integral part of what we wanted to do from a defensive point of view. So I had the conversations around what I was thinking, what's worked in the past, what didn't work, what needed to be improved, et cetera, et cetera. And so it gives me a bit of clarity of thought before you even go into the mini camp, by sounding out a couple of players. So I did that and then had an opportunity at the mini camp to talk to some smaller groups and some larger groups. So all of a sudden, before you come to the autumn series, you've had opportunities to catch up with players individually. You've caught up with players in some smaller groups. You've sounded some players out, what's worked, what hasn't worked, what we can be better with, what's important now. And then you can be really considered in what you bring to the camp. So by the time we got into the autumn series, although you can't always catch up with people in person because of the distance, and even the coaches on our coaching group, live all throughout England. Zoom, like what we're using now, is a useful tool. It's not the best tool, but it's a useful tool when you're working in that international environment when people live here, there, and everywhere across the country. So that's what I did, and we felt as though we really narrowed our focus to two or three things, and we worked really hard over that period of time, and that's the way that I've sort of done it in the past, and that's the way I thought was best to bring to a particular group. There's no point me coming in and having 10 things down on the whiteboard.
So did they change your mind? Did when you say, look, I've been thinking about this, and someone pipes up?
No, well, to start with, it's about what's worked, what do we need to be better with,
right?
And
you're putting it on them, and
I think for the coaches who coach at amateur level or underage level, there's obviously two or three influences in the team players who show some leadership qualities value a certain area of the game. It's important to get a feel for what they think. So yeah, in the first instance, it's about sourcing some information, because for me, I'm coming from outside the group. Not only am I coming from Australia, I'm coming from a different sport. So it'd be really arrogant of me to come in and think I've got all the answers, right? So I think that's any group that I've worked with, even as a head coach, you need to source what's worked, what hasn't worked, what's important now. That's sort of the basis of your planning, and I think that's what junior coaches can use as well. And it might have been reflecting on the previous season. What worked last year, what didn't work, or what could we be better and grow? And then, okay, what's really important now over this pre-season? Like I said before, at international level, you don't get the luxury to deconstruct different areas of your game that need improvement and reconstruct over a period of time. It's about, what's the big rocks here? What's the two or three things you really need to focus on and really drive them hard?
You've used the word processes a couple of times, and you hear the players talk about processes. Could you just explain what that means to a player and to you?
Well, I can't talk for the players, right? Because, I'm not a player anymore. I've been a player for a long period of time, but from my perspective, the processes I talk about is, okay, these are the two or three, focus areas or the two or three things that I'm really going to narrow my focus on as a coach this week. So how do I install them? And I think it's really important when you're trying to install something that you don't just touch on it once during the week, because that's not going to have a positive transfer to game day. So for the junior coaches, if you've got two training sessions, let's just say it's Tuesday and Thursday night, you wouldn't just touch on one part of your defence on the Tuesday night and think the players have got it for the Saturday afternoon game. The best way to do it would be to touch on that particular part of your defence on both Tuesday and Thursday night, because all of a sudden there's two opportunities for them to grasp that concept or that key focus area. So think about that from an international level perspective. We get four opportunities during the week to train. Four. leading into a game. So if something's really important, it's one of my big rocks as a defensive coach, I would want to touch on that all four times during the week, because then it would have some transfer to game day. Now, for people out there who like to read, I'd suggest that you do a bit of research in around Doug Lamov, who's an American guy. You might have even had Doug on one of your podcasts, but, Doug talks a lot about that. But, to be able to retrieve it on game day for us, we need to touch on it three or four times during the week. It's not just thinking, okay, we've got a five-minute defensive block here. Now you're playing, Scotland, Finn Russell is one of the key players. You touch on that for 5 minutes during the week and think the players are going to get it for the weekend's game. It doesn't work like that. I think it's the same in the junior space. Now, in the junior space, it's not all about performance. It's about educating the players as well. But I think if you've got your big rocks that you want to focus on that week, don't just touch on it for 5 minutes. You know, I'd suggest that you touch on it on the Tuesday night and also the Thursday night leading into your Saturday afternoon game.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put another link into the Doug Lemoff stuff. I mean, there's other stuff around that through retrieval practice, interleaving and all that sort of stuff. And also, I mean, the thing that you're making...
Dan, to cut you off, mate, that's the retrieval practice I'm talking about. Doug talks a lot about that.
So, yeah, he talks... And the other thing is sort of the cognitive load theory idea that you can't give the players 10 things to think about. It just needs to be one or two. So...
I'll give you an analogy that I use all the time when I talk to coaches about that, not giving them 10 things. So think if I've got 10 tennis balls, right? And just imagine I threw over Zoom 10 tennis balls to you, right? How many would you catch out of the 10?
Probably none of them.
Well, you might catch one or two,
if I'm lucky, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly right. So just imagine if I had those tennis balls numbered 1 to 10. And you catch one, right? You might catch the number 7. And then you've got your friend sitting in the lounge next to you there, and I throw the same 10 tennis balls to him, right? He might catch 2, maybe 3, but he might catch numbers 1, 2, and 10, which are 3 different points to what point you caught. You know what I mean? So think about a classroom, or think about a locker room or a team meeting, and you've got 10 things on the whiteboard behind you, and you think that the players are all going to walk out with those things locked away. Perfect. We know what we're doing this weekend. It's just not going to happen, because you might remember 2 of those 10 things. And it might be the first point and the fourth point. But your mate next to you might remember only 1 thing, and it could be the 10th point. So when you're walking out onto the field, they're not thinking about the same the same point. So that's where there's a lack of, I suppose, clarity, for want of a better term. So I just think, Matty, if I have 2 things on the whiteboard, it's like just throwing 2 tennis balls at you, you're more of a chance of catching 2 tennis balls. Now, if I threw the same 2 tennis balls to your mate, he's more of a chance of catching those 2 tennis balls. So, I would think that that tennis ball analogy is one that I use all the time, but it's essentially saying, narrow your focus, don't try and teach 10 things, try and really narrow and zone in on 1, 2, or 3 things at the absolute most.
And the other thing I think I really like about that is that instead of the players coming away with 6 or 7 different messages, they're all coming away with the same couple of messages. Of course, inevitably, there's different interpretations there, but at least you've narrowed the down. Now, another term you've just used, which I wanted to quiz you on, was the big rocks. So give me an example of a big rock that you might be using.
Just to give you an example, think about the Springboks. What do they do really well, Dan? If you're coaching against the Springboks, what's one thing you think that they do really well?
Well, they're going to pack you very, very hard, coming off the line very, very quickly.
Yep. So they'll blitz you. Yep. They will. They're very aggressive with their D. The other thing, so that's one thing that stood out to me. And the other thing that stood out to me was how good they are in the air.
Yeah, I was going to say the other thing is going to be the kick chase. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, think about a big rock versus. South Africa, for instance, a big rock's going to be trying to put kick pressure on their 9 or their 10 because they're so good in the air. Like, that's a big rock. That's something that you would focus on all week.
Right.
That's got to be a focus for you, right? So, that's what I mean by a big rock. You know, if they've got a weapon, how do you disrupt the weapon? How do you take away that weapon?
I see, right. So you'd focus on, it was interesting. I don't know how much you know Omar Mouname, the Bristol Bears defense coach, but I had him online the week before they played in a semi-final. And his big rock was Marcus Smith playing for Harlequins. And obviously you've come across Marcus in the last few weeks because he was such a dangerous player. And they knew if they could keep Marcus Smith under wraps, then they had a better chance. They couldn't. I mean, the best players sometimes outwit you. So that's going to happen. So the big rocks tend to be...
Sorry, Dan, just with the big rocks. I mean, it's probably less... it's more about action, like action words, you know. So kick pressure is an action word, isn't it? You know what I mean? Mm. So think about that. Like, you can actually visualize someone changing their pace to put kick pressure on a kicker, you know, who's you know, number 10, for instance, right? So that's something you can take away. For me, if I just had, for want of a better example, you know, Pollard. Yeah, Pollard is a name. That's not a big rock for me. You know, it's I would want players walking away with a specific action. Okay, so what's it actually look like? Yeah, so kick pressure, you can actually visualize that. All right, I've got to change my pace. I've actually got to do an action to perform that big rock. Now, I use big rock for want of a better word too, mate. But just what I'm trying to say is, you know, narrow your focus to two, maybe three things at the absolute most.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm thinking back to other times, people talking about keep the player on his left foot so he doesn't kick with his right. And so every time you line up, you try and maneuver him to his left foot to do that. So just another thing you just touched on was techniques. Now, in a week, four times with the players, is there any chance to work on technical stuff, or are you sort of saying... they've got to have got that already. I'm not going to even go there, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. That, like as I said before, I think that, you know, the club coaches do a really good job improving the technical side of players' individual skills. So at representative level, I think it's really important that, you know, you focus on the tactical side of things. So you want to look at, okay, so what, you know, tactically, what are our key focus areas, or big rocks for the week, and how are we going to train that? And then, you know, design games, design segments of training or games where you can actually then, install or focus on those big rocks in a game. So rather than doing it, in a closed drill, I think the best way to practice is by the use of games and design games and manipulate space and manipulate numbers and so on. And if I go back to the kick pressure, you know, I would design a kick pressure game. If that's what one of the big rocks is, I would design a kick pressure game that you would play three times or potentially four times that week, if that's one of your big rocks. And you might install it with doing some core skills, either before the session or an early session in the week. But essentially what I would want to do is use games to drive and install that particular focus area for the week. And we don't have time during test week to work too much on technique. It's predominantly around the tactical side of things, and then how do we train with intensity to try and replicate what they're going to experience in the weekend. I think that's really important. So, you know, we don't have a lot of coach talk time in between drills. It's really important to coach on the run or coach in the moment. It's really important that, we try and, use the game as our, as an indicator of how we want to train. You know, what's the game demand? What do the demands look like? And then we try and train, above that.
Well, I know that to anyone who's listening in is probably saying, right, the thing I'm only now focused on is what does that kick pressure game look like? So can you give us some sort of clues on what a kick pressure game might look like? Because I'm sure that coaches would be rushing out to do it now if they knew.
No, you can make it. You design it to what fits your particular group. But I'll just give an example. I won't use one that I used, that we used with England, but I'll give you an example of one that I've used in rugby league at NRL level and with the state of origin side. So essentially what we would do is put, we'd use goalposts down one end of the field, and we'd use, those big poles that you dig in the ground, and we'd put down 40 metres out. So literally 40 metres out from the goalpost. So that's one set of goalposts, 40 metres out from the other set of goalposts.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden, we've already manipulated the field, haven't we, Dan? We've, mm-hmm. we've made the field only 40 metres long rather than 100 metres long.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I was doing with the lead guys was I'd made it only three tackles or three phases, you know, in rugby union terms. So three phases, mm-hmm. must kick on the third phase. Mm-hmm. Must kick you have to kick by the third phase. So you can go all the way through to the third phase, but you must kick. Now, think about that. There's only three opportunities that you get. So there's more opportunities to put kick pressure on, okay? But also not only that, what's important – what do teams use the air? Because they send chasers into the contest, don't they? So you actually also get practice at protecting the drop zone of the ball and so on. So you get so many reps in a 4 minute period. So it's a really intense game. Play for 4 minutes, have 90 seconds break, then you play for another 4 minutes, or you might go 3 minutes, 90 seconds break, and 3 minutes. But it's a really high intense game, and you actually get plenty of reps. So think about if there's a kick within every three phases. So think about how many phases you would get in 4 minutes. Mm. Think about how many opportunities there are to put kick pressure on. And then what you can do is you can, if you're not at professional level, you can have one of your coaches, amateur level. I just want you to have a look at our kick pressure. Tick every time we have a change of pace. Cross every time we don't have a change of pace from the inside. Because when you put kick pressure on, you must change your pace, right? That's what you're looking for with your coach's eye. You're looking for a 2 or 3 metre change of intensity from the inside to put kick pressure on a kicker. That's what you look for.
Right. Okay. So imagine what that looks like. So you're saying a change of pace, change of pressure. So
change of intensity.
Yes. Yeah, so
you're not dawdling either, mate. You're not jogging. So I'm not gonna give someone a tick if they're jogging. You know, if the 10's kicking the ball out of hand and he's jogging from the inside, I'm not giving Dan, a tick for that one, am I? You know what I mean? I want to see a change of pace.
Glad you never watched.
So think, I want to see a change of intensity. But more the point around that game, mate, is, think of the opportunities to put kick pressure on. So that's one of your big rocks that week, and in the NRL, teams would use the because defences are so good and so tight, well, they were before the change of rules in the NRL, a lot of teams would go to the air. And, that what we see a lot in rugby union now, those kick passes, the cross-field kicks, well, they've been in league for a long period of time. So you play against teams that can really isolate a defensive winger and have a chasing wing into the contest. Well, if you want to defend really well, you've got to put kick pressure on the kicker, you've got to protect the drop zone and so on. So designing little games like that, and as I said, that game there, is it the best game in the world? Possibly not. Is it a good game? Yeah, I think it's a really effective game because what you've done is instead of over 100 metres, you've decreased it to 40 metres. You can manipulate the numbers, so you can play it 12-on-12, 10-v-10, 15-v-15, 13-v-13, whatever you want to do. You can put extra attackers on the attacking side. So it might be, 13, always have 13 attackers versus 11 defenders. You can manipulate the width, but the point of it is if you have to kick with inside your three phases, there's ample opportunities to have to go and change your pace from the inside to put pressure on. And you can manipulate the rules to suit, So, be creative there is probably what I'm saying to the coaches,
So now I'm thinking another one thing which Doug often emphasises and other emphasises is the game's not the teacher. So as the coach, you've got maybe one coach checking that intensity, which I think is very key, and I'm thinking about it, and of course that's key. You've got to notice what these players are doing. In terms of helping the players after the game to understand what's gone well and how to change their behaviours, how do you then intervene? Are you getting them together and asking them questions? Are you giving them a chance to feedback? How does that work to get the best out of that? Let's say that game's gone on for 10, 15 minutes and it's...
You wouldn't play that game for 15 minutes. So like I said before, you would play that game for maybe 3 minutes or 4 minutes, have a 90-second debrief. Mm. And the best way to do a debrief for me, or one way to do a debrief is... Get the two teams to huddle and give each other feedback themselves, and just have the two coaches, one with one group, one with the other group, and you're there to facilitate if they're going off topic or they're not given the feedback you think they need to be given, that's when you can sort of step in and help facilitate it by the use of questioning. But, okay, Bruce, you got 60 seconds here to work out what you did well and what you can be better with in the next four-minute block. And then you go back out and perform it again.
Yeah, you've got say, 3-4 games happen on the trot. You've got 60 seconds in between. They have a think about what they might do. They might try and apply that in the next one. So they've got, you're coaching sort of on the run like that. When the game's actually been played, you're observing, you're not saying anything?
No, yeah. It depends what you want to do with the coach. I'm not telling coaches what to do, you know. So some coaches like to coach a lot in the moment or on the run, and how much value you get out of that, I'm not sure. Some segments of training or some games or some drills you would get more input in that, but, you know, you're not out there on the field and behind the group either, you know. So how you want to do that is, you know, that's your coaching prerogative. But what I, you know, think about the game, let's just go back to that kick pressure game I spoke about. Play it for 3 minutes or 4 minutes, right? Make sure it's got high intensity. So the coaches have to have a couple of extra balls because the ball goes out of bounds. You want to get the ball in, get to your next job. You don't want to have it slow or sluggish. But after that 4 minutes, boys, in your huddles, you've got 60 seconds to yourself here. And just have one coach go with each of the groups. Give each other feedback, what you did well, what we can be better with. We're going to go back into that game. Right, you got 60 seconds. Way to go. They give each other some feedback. If they're going off topic or talking too much or not enough or whatever, the coach is there to try and step in and use his, you know, coach's questioning to generate that feedback. But essentially, they get then another opportunity to go back into the game and try and maintain what they were doing well in the previous four-minute block. But they get another opportunity to grow or improve what they need to be better with. And let's just say, for instance, they need to be better with, changing their pace and the kick pressure. They get another opportunity to go and do that in the next 3 or 4 minutes. So that's what I would do. And that essentially is a 10-minute block of training because you've got four-minute game, 90-second debrief into a four-minute game. And that's really powerful. If you're training Tuesday and Thursday night, if you did that on the Tuesday night, and then the Thursday night, because on the Saturday afternoon, there's a number 10 playing for the opposition school team who is fantastic at putting those crossfield kicks up or, you know, kicking downtown for space. All right, we know that kick pressure is going to be really important on this number 10. Then you've had two really intentional practices during the week or intentional games during the week that are focused on you know, one of your big rocks for that weekend's game. So that's, you know, so it's not about spending 50 minutes over to training. It's 2 10-minute blocks during the week. It's number one on your whiteboard, or it's number two on your whiteboard of the 3 key points for the week, but you're actually intentionally practicing.
So going back
I was just saying then, you know, so like I said, you know, you might want to install that in a little 4 or 5 minute core skills or basic segment, you know, before your warm up or after your warm up or, you know, before you actually play the game. But I think use the game. You know, the game sort of is the best teacher, and that's sort of essentially what coaches could do when they've only got 2 training sessions. But they know that the 10, the opposition team, you know, he's got a weapon, which is his boot, and he's fantastic at isolating, you know, defenders with that crossfield kick or finding space down, you know, down the middle of the field. Then, you know, that would be one way that I would try and train intentionally that big rock.
Now, thinking about intensity, one of the challenges for coaches is injury rates and keeping players fit for Saturday. How would you deal with that in terms of the sort of bone-on-bone contact?
Yeah, I think, the World Rugby has put out some really clear guidelines in and around, what that should look like. So, I think that it's really important that, over pre-season you plan, or for want of a better word, periodise the opportunities you have for contact. Because if you don't do any contact over pre-season, you're going to your first trial game, first friendly, as you call it over in the UK, then that's when there's going to be some impact injuries, isn't there? Because your body's not ready for it. But during the training week, you don't want to be beating each other up, you know, every minute of every session. And I think it's really important that you are really explicit and distinguish what bone-on-bone looks like versus what I would call body in front. So body in front is getting your body in front, not out to the side, not touch, but it's just body in front. You know, you're stepping in body in front and squeezing versus, you know, there might be a period of training on a Tuesday night where you're defending your trial line for 4 minutes or 6 minutes where it is bone on bone. And that might be your only contact for the week as far as like bone on bone. Mm. The rest of it, you want just body in front.
Mm.
And because you want to continue to train bad habits. So you don't want touch, you don't want reaching out there because players get bad habits. So you need body in front, but I think it's really important to be explicit and distinguish the difference between, you know, bone on bone versus body in front. And I think you need to give demonstrations to the players really early in your preseason, or right at the very start of your preseason, or right at the very start of your training week. Hey, this is what body in front looks like, or this is what bone on bone looks like, and then, yeah, the players got some clarity around what's expected there. But I think you can use pads, you know, when you're doing some tackle technique. I think, you know, for juniors, they can use pads as a way to practice the technical side of you know, contact without, you know, putting them, you know, I suppose at further risk of injury. But I think it's important. You can't go from doing no contact all pre-season to, you know, playing a game. That's when injuries occur, in my experiences.
Well, Anthony, I know that you're a very busy man and you've got some calls coming in. So just want to pick up with one last question then. So in a sense, you're a sort of new coach in a little bit because you're new coach into rugby union. But when you first went into coaching, looking back on that now, what would you be saying to new coaches who are starting out or maybe been in the game for a couple of years? You know, how would you challenge them to improve their craft? Because where you're at the moment, you're challenging yourself inevitably every single day because that's professionally how you improve. But from a new coach's point of view, what's some easy wins for them to make good progress?
Yeah, Dan, I'll just take you up on the first point. You know, I don't consider myself to be a new coach. I've been coaching professionally for 16 years. And prior to that, I was a university lecturer and a school teacher. And at both you know, those occupations, I coached you know, junior rugby league. So, yeah, I've been coaching for over 20 years. Now, for me, teaching's coaching and coaching's teaching. And I think the X's and the O's are the easy bit to learn, though. That's what I think. I think it's the processes or, you know, what the education, you know, the word they use in education is pedagogy, which just means the how-to, you know. So it's how you, you know, how you do things is what's important. So the X's and O's is I won't say easy to learn, but it's the easy bit to learn. It's the easier bit to learn. It's the other stuff that's you know, takes some time and you know, think back to our, you know, 10 points on a whiteboard versus 2 or 3 points on a whiteboard. That's the stuff that, shit, I got that wrong. You know, like I was trying to get these kids in under 16 to remember all these 10 things leading into to a game. That's the bit that you need to, you know, experience some successes and some failures with. But what I will say, whether you're a new coach, been coaching for 15 years, 16 years, whatever it is, you need to be curious. So I think it's really important that you go and observe other coaches, other teachers, not just in your own sport, but also other sports. I think that's the way that you learn. You know, you look at, because essentially if you go and watch a hockey coach, all right, it's an invasion sport. It's very different to rugby union, but it's an invasion sport. So essentially you're trying to get down one end of the court or of the field, or you're trying to defend that space. But what you should be looking at is the how-to, that you know, the process. You know, how does the coach communicate? How does the coach give feedback? How does the coach ask questions? What's the coach do at the end of the session to check for understanding? You know, how does the coach have a fast start to his training session or a fast start to his team meeting? So I'd be really curious, go and look at other sports, go and look at other coaches, you know, write down some notes, you know, what's one or two takeaways that you learned from that experience. But the main thing is be curious. And I don't think it matters whether you're a new coach or you've been coaching for 20 years, you've got to continue to be curious. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, Eddie picked up on with me. I'm sure it is, because he said that to me, you know, just always curious, always want to try and get better. You know, learn from your failures, learn from your successes. You know, there's going to be some challenges, there always is, but, you know, continue to learn, be curious. And I think that's one thing I'd love people to take away. You know, if you're, a coach or whatever level, continue to be curious.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you said there is do take some notes, because another thing that's come across is lots of people will listen and then go away and they can't remember. They can't remember what the one or two big rocks were, let alone because they haven't written anything down. And just the process of writing something down is a good way of just to sort of organize how you're thinking.
Dan, what I do is, you know, if someone's listening to this, you know, I challenge them, let's write down the two or three things that you've picked up. Now, you don't have to agree with what I say, but what's the two or three things that you walk away from this conversation with? You know, I would hope that one is, you know, if we just finish from that curious, you know, be curious if that was one. I think another one would be about narrowing your focus. So think of a tennis ball analogy. You know, rather than try and teach 10 things, really try and narrow your focus to two, maybe three things at the very most. That would be, you know, two really key takeaways, you know, from my conversation today. I think if people wrote those two things down, then they can, you know, get away. And the third one is that retrieval. You know, like, don't just think you can, you know, touch on something for 5 minutes during the training week and it's going to transfer to game day. You know, think of the double them off. So, you know, well, there's three things for your listeners. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting what you're saying, because inevitably everyone comes at it from a different angle, and some of those things, I mean, I hope I hear some of these things before. So for me, I would say big rocks for me. The other one is the intensity on the kick. I mean, I know that's a what, but in terms of noticing that and making a big difference. And these are the small things that you take into a training session next time you're out there, and it just helps you be a bit more confident about how you might deliver stuff. Anyway, Anthony, that's been brilliant. I mean, thank you very much for your time and the clarity and the energy, and just, I mean, I'm curious. You kept saying things and I was curious about that, and it's fascinating how you were talking about your approaches and I think the interesting thing was the rugby league coach's eye. Which made me that was interesting as well, because in a sense you talked to us about going to watch hockey training and going to watch other sports training. It makes me want to go and watch a lot more coaches as well and see what they're doing and how they're doing it. So this is all interesting. So Anthony, when you're back in the UK, when you're back with England?
Back in January, mate. Yeah, so just had Christmas here in Australia with the family, and then back across again. And you know, already busy sort of planning for the Six Nations campaign. Looking forward to that next challenge. That's going to be a tremendous tournament to be part of.
Yeah, well, I think all the English listening in will be very pleased to hear that. And have a lovely Christmas. Thank you very much for your time. And this is a Rugby Coach Weekly podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast and some of the notes from what we talked about today, I shall put it at the bottom. Go to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the podcast button. So, Anthony, thank you once again for your time.
Thanks, Dan. That's my pleasure, mate.
Great. And we look forward to speaking with you all very soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. If you want to hear more podcasts, head over to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the blogs tab to catch up on any episodes you've missed. We look forward to speaking to you again soon with more insights from coaches and experts from the world of rugby, sport, and learning.